Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting Pops on the River, an outdoor concert experience with songs from the Eagles featuring the Seven Bridges Band and the entire symphony, June 1st at McGrath Amphitheater. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa lawmakers have proposed hands-free driving bills, but they failed to advance in the legislature, and this year's legislative session was no different. According to the Iowa Department of Public Safety, drivers using a handheld device while driving are four times more likely to get into a serious crash. In just a moment, we'll hear about how more effective hands-free driving laws in our state could reduce deaths and injuries significantly, as they have already in several other states. I'll talk with Sergeant Alex Dinkla of the Iowa State Patrol and also Luke Hoffman of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. But first, a conversation I had earlier today with Peter and Joanne Bankson. In 2020, their 28-year-old daughter, Ellen, was killed by a distracted driver. Joanne and Peter, welcome to our program.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about Ellen's story.
As a parent, I cannot imagine the pain that the two of you have been through. I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing your story today to raise awareness about the problem of distracted driving. We truly appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. We hope that by really bearing witness to Ellen's tragic and senseless death, that we can change individual driving behavior.
Yeah. Before I ask you to recount the circumstances of your daughter's death in 2020, tell us about her. What was she like? In reading about her, it sounds like she was such a remarkable, promising young woman.
Yeah, you know, as parents, you want to be objective and say, yeah, that Ellen was amazing. But when we heard from teachers from elementary school through high school, we heard from friends in the Charles City community where she lived the last 5 years of her life, coworkers, it just reminded us how special she was and how she wanted to make a difference in this world.
Yeah, she was a pretty accomplished, driven young gal, the kind of child that you find, you know, with a flashlight under the covers, reading, you know, getting to the end of that chapter, because she has to know what happened and was continuously reading. She was the one to beat in math and science competitions. As a seventh grader, she came to us and said, was a little bit alarmed because she calculated that she was going to run out of math classes. And, you know, as parents, we're like, well, good, maybe you can, you know, have a little more fun and not have to take 0 hour or summer school. But no, Ellen wanted to go to an East Coast boarding school, and that was her answer.
Because education was really important to her. And of course, we said, no, we want you to stick around for a while.
Right.
Yeah, she did find a way to weasel herself into a Stanford high school program. So she ended up graduating from two high schools.
Yeah. And also, I understand, a graduate of Yale and Columbia. She became an environmental engineer and then found her way back to the Midwest here to work in Charles City.
Correct.
Her life ended when she was just 28 years old. She was biking outside of Charles City. I understand the crash happened in daylight on a straight, mm-hmm. unobstructed road. What can you tell us about the circumstances?
Yeah, it was a Sunday afternoon. It was a day we'll never forget, getting a phone call about a Jane Doe that was found along the side of a road. And if we knew a woman there, as a parent, it's something you never want to, a phone call you never want to take. So she was out for a ride. A driver on his cell phone was looking at trying to purchase or tracking a boat sale on social media. According to the State Patrol investigation, he was traveling at least 55 miles an hour, traveled almost 3 football fields, and he still didn't even see her when he drifted off onto the shoulder and threw her 28 feet into a ditch. He had to turn around to find out what he hit. He didn't even know, didn't recognize what flew off his grill and into his windshield and was projectiled out into this ditch. The impact sheared her bicycle seat off of her bike, and all of her reflectors and everything were damaged. And he came back and confessed to the emergency responders that he was on his phone, and it was a dumb thing to do, and he never saw her. He confessed on camera that that's what he was doing. Literally 2 years ago this week, after a year and a half, we were in the courthouse in Floyd County, hearing this testimony, seeing everything played out on these videos and these pictures of her curled body up on the ditch, being loaded on a stretcher. It was like living it all over again, that first phone call. And in the trial, the judge there, she decided that under the current law, despite the confession, the driver and the case was dismissed, because they couldn't prove that he was manually operating. He was using his phone, but not manually operating the phone at the time, even though he confessed he was using his phone. And so he never spent a day in jail for killing our daughter or anything like that.
Yeah, the driver charged with reckless homicide by vehicle, the case dismissed, as you said, and it cannot be appealed. But let's get to the heart of the matter here going forward. The law passed in Iowa in 2017, meant to end driving while texting and other distracted driving behind the wheel. What did the case of your daughter reveal to you about Iowa's current law and this huge loophole in it?
Exactly. There is a loophole, and it doesn't discourage people from being cognitively distracted, physically distracted, manually distracted. Instead of keeping both eyes on the road and hands on the wheel, people think that they can multitask. And that's a myth. It's been proven to be a myth. It shows that people can literally get away with using their phone, and it's just a matter of time before tragic events like our daughter's, Ellen's experience will happen.
Yeah, we know that it really was the intent of Iowa's law to not let, something like this go unrecognized, and there be some sort of accountability. So we know that the law is not needs to advance. Technology's changed, and the laws need to keep up with the technology.
Yeah. Des Moines Register investigation, you're probably aware of this from a couple of years ago, finding that this is definitely not an isolated case. Dozens of drivers who received tickets under the 2017 laws won their cases. They simply argued there was no evidence that they were actively texting or using social media when they were pulled over. And that was the case in your daughter's death as well?
Yes, that's fair to say. We've met with several law enforcement officers, those that were at the scene where our daughter was killed, and just folks around Des Moines there. And they tell us they feel like their hands are tied, and they want to make the roads safer. They want to protect people on Iowa's roads, and they're hamstrung, as you described.
Yeah, and we know that more effective laws enacted in other states, they see very quickly fewer crashes caused by distracted driving. What is your understanding? And we'll hear more from Sergeant Dinkla of the Iowa State Patrol in just a moment, and also Luke Hoffman of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. What is your understanding of why more effective, better distracted driving laws continue to stall in the Iowa legislature year after year?
I believe that people don't fully appreciate the ramifications of distracted driving. They don't realize that when you pick up your phone, it's like adding a blindfold. It's like you're putting on a blindfold, and your vision really is indeed impaired. Your reaction time is reduced. You're essentially driving drunk, and we'd like to very closely correlate distracted driving with drunk driving. The effects are very similar, and the results can be just as deadly.
Yeah, the actual number of crashes is greater than drunk driving in this country. It's, 20, 30 years ago when I started driving, maybe show my age a little bit, but when I saw somebody weaving or going slow down the road, I was thinking they were under the influence of alcohol or something. And now when I see that, 9 times out of 10, they're on their phone. You got to honk the horn for them to move out of the stoplight. I mean, people are distracted and swerving, and you need to watch out for them. I mean, it's literally a road hazard. There's nearly 800 crashes a day in this country.
Injuries and deaths.
And yeah, not to mention injuries and the deaths associated with distracted driving. And all the experts will tell you that's more than likely a higher number than actually is being captured at this point. So it's a national safety issue, let alone an issue in Iowa, for sure.
You know, one thing I'd like to add is there's even AAA has even identified a hangover effect. So, you know, we've all done it. We've sat at the stoplight and, you know, glanced at our phone, checked those little, that incoming text. But there is a what's called a hangover effect. And for up to 24 seconds, when you look up, you are not fully appreciating the entire windshield and your brain is not able to give you the appropriate feedback. So you're missing things. People don't just pop out of nowhere. They're there. You just didn't see them.
Maybe to get back, Ben, to your original question, you know, what's going on in the legislature so this isn't being stronger? We heard explanations from representatives in Iowa that, you know, they're worried about a freedom. They're worried about, you know, taking the choice away from a person. Well, I think we should flip that around. And you basically taking the freedom of somebody having their life or their limbs, their financial independence away because you're causing accidents, like you mentioned earlier, at least four times greater chance of having a crash if you're using and distracted by your phone. You're making the choice. That's why we use crash instead of an accident. It's not an accident. You make a choice to be on your phone, to be distracted.
Well, Peter and Joanne, Bankston, thank you for this conversation. Joanne and Peter are the parents of Ellen Bankston in 2020. Ellen, at the age of 28, killed by a distracted driver outside of Charles City. Peter and Joanne, I sit here with such a heavy heart for your story, but also such admiration that you are telling your story so that other parents, other family members will not suffer what you have suffered the past few years. Peter and Joanne, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more discussion on improving laws here in Iowa concerning distracted driving. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting Pops on the River, an outdoor concert experience with songs from the Eagles featuring the Seven Bridges Band and the entire symphony, June 1st at McGrath Amphitheater. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
And we're back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This portion of the program talking about Iowa's distracted driving laws, also bike safety. The first part of the program, if you were with us, we heard from Peter and Joanne Bankston, parents of Ellen Bankston. In 2020, their daughter Ellen killed by a distracted driver while biking outside of Charles City. And for years, Iowa lawmakers have struggled with this, have proposed hands-free driving bills, but they've failed to advance in the legislature. According to the Iowa Department of Public Safety, drivers using a handheld device while driving are four times more likely to get into a serious crash. Let's learn now more about how more effective hands-free driving laws in our state could reduce deaths and injuries significantly, as they have already in several other states. Joining us now in IPR's Des Moines studio, Luke Hoffman, Executive Director of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Also with Luke in the studio, Sergeant Alex Dinkla, Public Information Officer with the Iowa State Patrol. Sergeant Dinkla, welcome back to you.
You bet. Thank you for having us. It's always a pleasure when we're invited on the radio show to be able to talk about some great laws and just things that we can affect change on here in Iowa.
Yeah, that's what we want to do in this case, hopefully, just to raise awareness here. And I know both of you were listening to that conversation recorded last week with Peter and Joanne. Let me start with you, Sergeant Dinkla.
How many other cases are there like the one we just heard about? What can you tell us in terms of statistics or examples that come to mind for you here in Iowa? This is not an isolated case.
You know, the Bankston family has been an absolute strong advocate. Their voice and their message, we continue to let them advocate because they're being a voice for all of the unspoken, the people that can't advocate for themselves anymore. And tragically, we are still experiencing loss of life and injuries as we continue to see people. As each day goes on, it's only happening more and more that people are on those devices. You know, just here a month ago of a quick case that we've got a young 14-and-a-half-year-old, 15-year-old boy that was only a quarter mile from his house, a quarter of a mile from his house. And tragically, he did lose his life. And we found out later that what was he doing? All he was doing was trying to activate a Spotify playlist on his phone so he could enjoy a drive from his house to school with his music. And he had ran off the road and tragically hit a creek embankment and ended up losing his life. And those are just, that's just one of many stories. We've already got numerous others. But, you know, we wanted to have change happen now so that we don't have to keep bringing up these statistics that are affecting many of our communities all over the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Sergeant Dinkla, you and your colleagues have, you know, many in the Iowa State Patrol sort of predate our fixation on these electronic devices. And you've seen firsthand the trends here, haven't you? I mean, we can talk about statistics, but we all have experienced it of a certain age that it didn't used to be that people were, you know, driving around town, outside of town, and having one hand on the steering wheel and then having the other hand there looking at a screen.
You know, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the things that we have to do, and us being leaders, us being advocates, we have to step up and we have to be the ones to want to affect change and stay current with the technology. I can tell you that we just, as our own state patrol, we saw this being a problem amongst our own ranks and our own force ourselves. We have our computers. That's how we have to do our jobs in our computers. But we saw this being a problem with our officers, our troopers being on their computers, or is this a temptation to be on that device? Mm-hmm. We took upon ourselves to enact a program that disabled those computers so they cannot be used while we're driving down the road. And that's simply what we're trying to advocate amongst all other people, is let's get these devices out of their hands so it's not a temptation. Because let's face it, we all know if we have that device readily in our hand, in our lap, in the cup holder, and we hear that chime, we hear that message go off, it's the temptation is there to want to reach down, grab it, and just look at it. But if we get that device simply out of those hands, we know that it's gonna make lives change and it's gonna save lives. And that's something that we're very strongly advocating for, and we're trying to get people to support that message. And that's what the Bike Coalition has strongly supported, that movement.
Yeah, and we know, we've all had this thought process, Luke and Sergeant Dinkla, oh, I'll just look at this text. You know, you're playing the odds. It's not going to happen to me. We have that, right? It's just, oh, I can do this. I hear about it. It's not that we're not aware of it. It's that when we do it, we don't think it will happen to us.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Luke with the Iowa Bicycle Coalition just kind of chiming in on that. And that's why we support the Governor Traffic Safety Bureaus. There is no such thing as a good distracted driver campaign, and another awareness campaign on this same issue of trying to raise awareness on reducing distracted driving, trying to bring awareness to the issue. You know, it comes back to the question of who do we want to be as a society? Do we want to be a society that kind of owns up to this, something that we're all culpable at some level, whether it's eating while driving or whether it's being on a device of some kind? We're all culpable at a certain level, you know, and so it becomes about who do we want to be as a society. And in terms of government and public policy, it's about what is the first obligation of government? and by extension, law enforcement, who's on the front lines of this, trying to combat this on a daily basis. It's about protecting people. And that's what hands-free does. We know in universally, without exception, every single state that has passed this law has seen a transformational, statistically significant reduction in lives that are lost. You know, and usually when we talk about good public policy, we think, oh, is it effective? You know, how do we evaluate it? We know that it works. Hands-free works. It's one of the most
effective. Luke, do you have any numbers to go along with that? I know other states also in the Midwest have enacted this in recent years. Any specifics there you could give us?
Sure. So if you look at, you know, even if you look at some of the different iterations of hands-free in Ohio, for example, have seen a statistically significant reduction in hands-free. They have, you know, a version of hands-free that isn't our necessary first preference. It would be kind of a watered-down version. But even there, you see in the last 6 months since they, enacted that policy, a drop. I don't have those exact numbers and figures in front of me offhand, but I know that they've seen a reduction in the last 6 months in terms of lives lost and fatalities.
Mm-hmm. A question from one of our listeners. I think this might be directed best to you, Sergeant Dinkla. Peter in Des Moines writes, I am not comprehending why the driver who killed the daughter of your guest was not convicted of killing her, whether or not he was on his phone or otherwise distracted. Peter writes, is it not current law that a driver is always ultimately responsible for not hitting other cars or bikers on the road? He goes on, I really just do not understand. I do not get it. Can you help us understand? What is missing, he adds, that allows drivers to kill with impunity with no consequences?
You know, that's a very good question, and I'd be definitely happy to answer that. And one of the things that I've been speaking about quite a bit when we talk about why Iowa law enforcement wants to go hands-free is because there is too much what I'm calling gray area. There's too much of those different, as the Banksons previously talked about, those loopholes. That would be another reference that we're referencing, that gray area where whether it's law enforcement, whether it's the prosecution, they're finding different ways to be able to navigate that law and slip through the cracks. And when we go to hands-free, I don't think we can argue, was that device in your hand or was that device not in your hand?
Right, because right now, and give us the perspective of law enforcement, Iowa State Patrol and other law enforcement, under the 2017 laws, if you argue after something that if there is no evidence that you're actively texting or using social media, then you're off the hook, so to speak, if you want to be.
You know, that when we look at what law enforcement has to deal with right now, we have to figure out in a split second whether somebody is under the age of 17 or below. We have to find out because those folks are not allowed to have that device in their hands, but yet they are allowed to use a GPS. And then we have to figure out, is that person 17 or is that person 19? Because when they're 19, they're allowed to make a phone call, but they're not allowed to text. They're not allowed to use social media. But mm-hmm. then we have some gray area, whether they can watch a Netflix movie or different thing like that. And they are still allowed to use the GPS. So there's so much gray area that a law enforcement officer is supposed to decide whether I can or can't pull this person over. And then when it comes to the prosecution and we start the defense and prosecution lay out their cases and they're looking at, okay, can they or can't they? Well, there's a question on this, so let's take this up. And that's exactly what the Banksons faced when they were in their trial with their advocating for their daughter. And so simply put, hands-free does make change. We looked at Minnesota. Minnesota was one that a number of years ago enacted a hands-free law up there. And shortly after they enacted that hands-free legislation and it went into effect, they saw a 15% reduction in their crashes. Mm. That is change.
That's
huge. Is what's going to work. And when we look at last year, having one of the highest fatality numbers at 377 last year, we want to reduce that, and we have not seen under 300 fatalities here in the state of Iowa since 1925. Mm. And we know that we can do it, but we have to have everybody's support to make sure we get this done. We're out here working day and night, but we need to make sure that we're putting other things in place to make this a safe place to drive and operate a vehicle here in Iowa.
Luke Hoffman, give us so a clear-cut law, you said, you know, Ohio had a watered-down law but still more effective than Iowa's current law. what would be the most effective law that you think would be reasonable for drivers to abide by?
Yeah, so a great specific on this would be SF 547, which is what we call the Clean Hands Free bill that passed out of the Iowa Senate, not this last session, but two sessions ago. And what made it a quote-unquote clean hands-free bill is it wasn't coupled with any other policies. It was strictly about hands-free and distracted driving. And the only exception in that would be to – is a one-touch exception where you could, you know, answer a call or decline a call. But otherwise, you cannot, you know, use your phone while driving, have it up to your ear. It has to be Bluetooth. And that's – we know that that's scientifically the safest thing as far as public safety and awareness are concerned and your attentiveness while driving.
Right.
And the question earlier about – and I think just what the Bankstons talked about with a, kind of our understanding of distracted driving being – you know, essentially the same and no different than driving while under the influence. I mean, it's kind of like the question of, you know, were you drinking beer or were you drinking wine when you were inebriated on the road? It's like, does it matter where the distraction is coming from, whether it was from a device or whether it was from some, you know, social media or texting? It's all the same. The net effect is that you're less safe when you're on the roads.
Mm-hmm. To talk about what's happened in the legislature, perhaps you Sergeant Dinkla, to what do you attribute the stalling out of attempts in past sessions, perhaps this most recent session, of getting more effective laws here?
You know, we've looked at the State Patrol being a strong supporter of the hands-free. This is something that we've advocated for and we've supported for the last several years, and we've had strong support out of the Senate. In fact, almost unanimous results out of the Senate that mm-hmm. we've seen. Unfortunately, we have not seen the results out of the House of Representatives, and we're going to continue advocating, educating whoever has any questions with that. We know one of the things is that folks feel that it might be a little infringement on some rights as far as telling people whether they can or can't have that device in their hand. Some people feel it's supportive to put that device up to the ear and still talk on the phone. But as we've mentioned before, we know the statistics are there. We know that there's gray area there. And if people are still tempted to have that device in their hand, the room for error is great there, that people are still going to abuse that privilege to be able to drive and are going to be on that phone. We know that. And so we're going to continue advocating. We're going to continue educating amongst anybody that has any questions, because we know hands down, get that phone out of that hand, and fatalities are going to drop.
And with this varying state to state, Luke, I mean, you have to be aware, as you do in so many other areas of life, each state's laws concerning cell phones are different when you're driving, aren't they? And wouldn't it be better if it was uniform and we all abided by what would be a reasonable expectation for a driver behind the wheel?
Yeah, I think the way to think about this is the most common objection to hands-free is just one word, that freedom that was mentioned, right? But going back to what the Bankstons were talking about, you know, oftentimes we're offered this false choice, freedom or public safety, freedom or saving lives. And I think that I got to call that out as a false choice. I think we can have more freedom by protecting people and having a culture change around how we our relationship with these devices that are causing these fatalities and injuries, right?
Yeah.
And so the way I would like to think about this is that this is my generation's seatbelt law. Yeah, I'm sure that the freedom was raised as an objection before we had universal seatbelt laws, going back to the 1986, I believe, when we had kind of federal level seatbelt requirements in every state. And the same is true here. When you think about distracted driving, 34 states that have passed it now, if we were to have this universal across the whole country, which I would certainly support as the Bicycle Coalition, I think that would be one of the most dramatic things in terms of saving lives that we could possibly do in public policy. I think it would be a generational impact yeah. in terms of lives saved and people being more aware on the roads.
Right. And we're not saying that it's hands-free driving devices are completely without distraction. I mean, we have plenty of distractions in our cars, the radio, the
right.
drink in your cup holder. Mm-hmm. This, to be clear, because we're not wanting to fall into the all or nothing trap here, this is just reduces the level of distraction is what you're saying.
Yeah, and to a degree that the impact, the outcome of that policy is what I would call transformational. You know, it's not just like 1% or 2%. We're seeing like statistically huge significant impacts in terms of life saved. And just thinking about all of the other Ellens that are out there who aren't here to raise their voices, to tell those stories because of the tragedies that have happened to them and their families, we have to be cognizant of that.
We have about a minute left, less than a minute. What can individuals listening to this program do to make their voices heard about distracted driving?
You know, one of the things that we want to try to stretch out there to get out there the information is a lot of the data is far underreported. We look at the property damage crashes, for instance. We know that there's laws out there to go investigate a fatality crash. We are able to get into people's cell phones to determine if they were on it or not. The data out there does not support that for the property damage crashes. Please stay off those phones. We don't want people to have those little fender benders. We're opening the roadways up. We want to make sure that we affect change.
Okay, thank you very much. Sergeant Alex Dinkla of the Iowa State Patrol and Luke Hoffman, Executive Director of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. Gentlemen, thank you for coming into our Des Moines studio today.
You bet. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up after a break, my conversation with a Sudanese-American and resident of Iowa. He'll tell us about the brutal civil war in his homeland and how it's impacting the local Sudanese community here in Iowa after a short break.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Sudan's brutal civil war has now entered its second year. No end in sight for one of the world's most catastrophic humanitarian disasters. The North African country was plunged into chaos in April of 2023 when long-simmering tensions between its military and the paramilitary, known as the Rapid Support Forces, became street battles in the capital of Sudan, Khartoum. Thousands have been killed. More than 9 million people are thought to be internally displaced in Sudan. 1.5 million refugees have fled into neighboring countries. Joining me now to discuss 1 year of the conflict and how it's impacting the Sudanese community here in the U.S., here in Iowa, Ayman Sharif joins me, current resident of Coralville, formerly of Iowa City. He's a Sudanese American, also executive director of the Center for Worker Justice of Eastern Iowa. Ayman, welcome to our program.
Hey, thank you, Ben, and I'm really grateful for inviting me for this opportunity. Thank you so much.
I understand you immigrated to the U.S. Over 10 years ago. You've lived, I think, all of that time here in Iowa, completed degrees at the UI, and as I mentioned there, you're working in our community here. But let's talk about the crisis in your homeland. It's largely been eclipsed by other conflicts, Israel's war in Gaza, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, also that anarchy in Haiti. Meanwhile, the war in Sudan is often called the Forgotten War. It has caused tremendous amounts of human suffering. Help us, first of all, Ayman, understand what this conflict is about. Sudan, not too long ago, was on the path to democratic civilian rule.
Yeah, I just like you saying that it is dubbed the Forgotten War. And that just makes me remember that this is the first time actually in Sudan, which is well known for being a peaceful place, and Sudanese as peaceful people, to witness this scale of armed conflict since the inception of the Sudanese state back in 1956, the modern Sudanese state. And it is just like really something that many would never have thought about that will happen in Sudan. And yes, I mean, the conflict, you asked me about the background of the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so as we all know, the conflict erupted on April of last year but definitely it has its roots and backgrounds that go back ways longer than this time. Probably the 30 years of the dictatorship of the former Islamic regime played a big role in weakening the state and making it like really vulnerable enough to witness this kind of horrible conflict as we see it right now.
Yeah. The rapid support forces, as the paramilitary is known, and the army have turned against each other. Why? Is that easy to explain?
Well, from the surface, you would see that the rapid support forces has been described as part of the military. But if you look back to the creation of these forces and everything, you would notice that basically the troops were created to support the former regime of Sudan. So it kind of grew up to create its own independence and its own force. And that was the situation. So even though the forces looks from the outside as part of the military, meaning that it is controlled by the state, but to a great extent, that was not the case. And it was kind of a freelancers that they can serve the state or they can go against the state if conditions arises.
Yeah. Is there, Ayman, an ethnic or religious component to this conflict?
There is no religious component that can be pointed out. The ethnic component can be noticed in the formation of the rapid forces. Basically, when the forces were formed at the beginning, they were formed to encounter the rebel movements that were growing in the margin, specifically in the western part of the Sudan. And during the early 2000s, those rebel movements forming in western Sudan were, most of them were from what we call African descent. Like we hear pointing to Arab backgrounded tribes and African tribes. So the people who were really raising concerns against the central government, many or most of them were from Africans, non-Arab groups. And therefore, when the militia was formed, it was basically was formed of nomad Arab groups who were really having like a lot of conflicts and a lot of differences with other tribes that shared the region with them. So that made mostly the creation of the rapid forces coming from those Arab troops.
If you've just joined us, my guest for this portion of the program is Ayman Sharif, a longtime resident of Iowa, a Sudanese American, and we're talking with him about the conflict in his native Sudan, a brutal civil war now entering its second year. Let's talk about the suffering going on. Of course, thousands have been killed. I read in the introduction, millions forced from their homes. More than twice that number, I understand, facing acute food shortages. Some people left with little choice now but to flee. Some are fleeing multiple times. What can you tell us about the humanitarian catastrophe in your homeland currently?
Yeah. So as a background, the 30 years of really bad systems, bad regime in Sudan really caused a lot of people basically to concentrate in urban settings, not even many of them. So, for example, Khartoum, the capital, during the time grew from probably like a small, not really big population into more than 10 million, making it like one of the largest like urban cities. And that is also the same with other big cities. So, and the conflict when erupted, actually, it, unlike any other time in the past, it started in Khartoum. So it started at the center. And you can imagine this level of fighting happening where among all those people, all those civilians. So that caused a very big displacement of people. And that happened over stages. Basically, people started to move out from places like Khartoum to where they thought could be like more safe. But then like to Al Jazeera region, which is the neighboring region, and further north to the northern states, close to the border with Egypt and stuff. But then the fight followed, and people found themselves like several times, as you just pointed, moving from one place to another. And that caused a lot of problems, as you would imagine, including the safety problems. It also included the medical issues, the environmental issues, everything. The places where people moved, most of them were not really prepared to receive these numbers of people coming all of a sudden without any preparations, without any resources or logistics. There was no international efforts to accommodate the movement and the displacement of all those peoples. People piled by the borders, even the bordering countries like Ethiopia, Egypt, and Chad. All of those countries also trying to better organize and control this sudden move of millions of people were also causing more problems to get the people piled in those borders, not even understanding how to deal with the problem.
Mm-hmm. Ayman, you are a Sudanese American, longtime resident of Iowa. There are tens of thousands of Sudanese and Sudanese Americans in this country. What are the conversations like about this conflict among the people from Sudan that you know here in Iowa and elsewhere in this country?
Yeah, I mean, as you would imagine, people are very troubled with this conflict. To a great extent, and during long times since the conflict erupted, people were really confused and not knowing which and which. Information is not available for people to understand if there are any possibilities or potentials that this will stop, or even understanding the causes of the conflict themselves. They all share the concerns about families and beloved people who are left now facing those awful conditions. Of course, many of the people, due to the kind of strong connections and family bonds, are like finding themselves are obligated to try and help and solve the problems at their individual levels, since there is no larger scale intervention. So you see a lot of people financing when the families are moving or are resettling, relocating somewhere else, this place. So all those, most of those are paid by people like us who are here and are having more access to like financial resources. So many of those resources are now serving to cover for the situation back in Sudan and in places where Sudanese are now relocated or displaced.
Yeah. Do you, Ayman, do you have contact with friends or loved ones in Sudan, your homeland, now? Are you hearing firsthand from them?
Yeah, we do hear from them all the time. Actually, some of the people from Sudan and Sudanese, American Sudanese, just move back and forth from the places where the conflict, away from the conflict zones. So, and in addition to that, I mean, communication has always been going on with families and relatives and friends and so forth. So people are not only a group of people, but generally Sudanese keep good connections with their acquaintances and friends and relatives back in Sudan.
Yeah, it must be very painful for you and other Sudanese and Sudanese Americans to see this from afar and feel helpless, I suppose.
That is very true. And yeah, I mean, oftentimes now when people are communicating over our internal networks here, the most prominent thing you see is death, because every single day you see a lot of announcement of a person who has been lost for fighting, either killed in a gun shooting or other conditions also leading to death, maybe illness and sickness and lack of medical treatment. All these situations are causing the toll of this to raise really high between Sudanese right now.
Yeah. Well, Ayman, I understand a new round of peace talks is scheduled to resume soon, led by the main players and the regional players there too. Sudan really needs to get to return to its pathway to a democratic civilian rule. What are your hopes for the future?
Well, I really hope the regional and global forces to rethink about the humanitarian situation in Sudan and come up with better schemes and scopes than what is happening now, because apparently what I see now is more of the global and regional interest in Sudan. That is the fuel of this war. And if that continues to be, then the war, we're not hoping really to see the war ending up soon. Unless the issue in Sudan are thought of in a different way than what it is now. Remember, you know, in my mind and in the mind of many, this conflict is not a domestic conflict. This is a conflict that is very well fueled by the interest and the desires of global economic powers to, in one way or another, control this area. And therefore, there will not be a hope, in my mind, for a change until everything is thought of in a different way than what it is right now.
Okay, well, thank you for coming into our studio. Ayman Sharif, a Sudanese-American, longtime resident of Iowa. We are hoping for the very best for those in Sudan. Thank you for explaining it to us.
Thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it.
Today's program was produced by Samantha McIntosh. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.